Are you good?
Yeah.
All right. This podcast is a podcast that is done for fun, for entertainment. We are not a credible source, except for this case. I fucking killed it. Anyway, I might be credible. But welcome to It Is What It Is. I'm Sean Marie.
I'm Jean.
And, okay, so I'm not a liar, technically. I know I told you guys I was going to do the toy box killer.
Uh-huh.
And then I told you guys about my love for Morbid and all that. And so I thought about it and I was like, they did it so perfectly that maybe I won't do it yet.
Yeah.
Just maybe I won't. And the only reason why that happened is because I typed it in, right, into the Google search bar, the toy box. And it did bring up the toy box killer, but underneath the toy box, it was like, could you kind of, sort of, maybe meant toolbox?
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, who the fuck is the toolbox? And it said killer, so I was like, ooh, I'm intrigued.
Yeah.
Come to me.
Yeah.
So I click it.
Mind blown.
These two motherfuckers put the toy box to shame.
No.
Like, I was telling Robin, because I go hide in the back of the store on my first break on Sundays, and I do my writing and my whatevers and have fun, and I entertain Robin. Well, distract her from her work is what I do, but I entertain her.
We'll call it different things.
Yeah, we could call whatever the fuck we want.
Yes.
Anyway, so I'm back there, and I'm kind of telling her about it, but I don't want to blow too much, so she still has to listen, and I still get her view, and her views, and, but at the end of our conversation, I noted publicly that if I had to choose between the boxes, toy box all the way.
Yeah.
And that's horrible to say.
It's your opinion.
We'll get it. We will do both.
Yeah.
And the toolbox was not very publicized.
Oh, that's why I've never
And heard mainly of because much. Of how bad it was. And it was so bad that for the first time in 29 years of my life, of my existence, I had to stop reading a murder story and take a breath. I had to walk away for a second.
Go to your happy place.
And I did. And like kind of woo-saw myself and be like, okay, let's go, kids, okay? And so... And that was the first time it ever happened.
Mm-hmm.
That reading it physically made me ill. And it's horrible. There is an audio clip, but we're not going to play it. And if you can make it listening to it longer than I did, and I think I made it, the video I think is like 17 minutes long. I think I made it to like 7, 8, something. I made it pretty high because I was almost kind of proud of myself. And then I'll tell you guys what part that when that happened, I was like, oh, I'm done. Oh, I'm so done. But
wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's horrible.
You have piqued my interest.
Yes.
Because if you are, I don't know, should we just do it?
Well, okay, so... There is a Wicked Attraction episode on this, which I watched it. And the show version that they give you on the show is Disneyland.
Yeah.
Compared to what truly happened. They left a ton of shit out on the show version. They mention the big stuff, but they just mention it. They were like, oh, this is what happened. Move on to this. They just really wanted to put...
Maybe they didn't have time to do it all.
I just think they were trying to do the story, but not do the story.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? But anyway, so their crime span is from June 24th to October 31st, 1979. 5 months. The show premiered on TV. It's Wicked Attraction Season 2, Episode 6. November?
Mm-hmm.
No. I don't know. October 25th of 2017. I have no why that was I wrote down the number and not, like, the month. And so I was like, January, February, March, April, May.
Oh, that's what you were doing.
Yeah. And so I, fuck, yeah, October. I feel confident with it. Yeah. Anyway. So they are before the Toy Box Killer, but they're at the same time as, like, BTK, Hillside, Strangler, and all that shit. And this is the, they're out of California as well. There's
BTK is the one I have to do, huh?
Yeah. Wait. There's five victims total that were murdered, and a good old-fashioned true collared snitch. That's a, he's a criminal, but he took the right path on this one. Mainly, I don't know if it was because he had, like, morals, or if it was, like, a good bargaining chip. I'm not sure. But I kind of wrote this out a little bit better than I normally do. I kind of wrote it as a script, kind of, so that I could keep myself on track, because it's huge, and it's long, and it's fucked up, and I didn't want to mistake in anything. Okay.
Wow.
Yeah.
Here we go.
Like, shit's gonna get serious. You might want to do that. Okay. In 1977, two inmates first meet at California's men's colony, okay? The first year these inmates are together, they kind of tiptoe around each other. Kind of like, he is, looks cool, don't know if he's cool. He's in this prison, I'm in prison. We could be friends. So, but in 1978, Lawrence Bittaker and good old, and Roy Lewis Norris is his name. His name's Roy. So we have
Roy.
Yeah. So we have Lawrence and Roy. Like I said, they're best friends in prison. So they become best friends in 1978.
In New York?
No, California.
Oh, California.
And they discover that they share some of the same interests and some of the same likes. Sex, such as sexual violence, predators, rape, burglary, robbing, you know, those type of things. That's what we share. Norris Roy says that he loves the looks on terrorized women's faces.
What sparks this conversation in prison? Usually the rapists and...
Oh, we'll get into it. Oh, I'll tell you why we have conversations like this in prison.
Oh, I know what you're looking for.
Mm-hmm. I think there's one over there. So like I said, Norris is telling him, is telling Lawrence Bittaker about how much he loves the scared looks on women's faces. Bittaker didn't have any sex crimes before meeting Norris. When he told Norris what he was into and everything else, that he would, they would, their main plan that they come up to, okay, is that it's a, first it's a fantasy. Okay, I'm going to start it like that because I do make it very clear that at first this is a fantasy. The fantasy is when they get out of prison that they are going to get some type of vehicle and they're going to go around raping and torturing and killing teenage girls.
Oh.
That's the foreseen plan that we're going to do.
You don't want to get a job when you get out. Just do that.
Yeah. So, then it kind of turns from fantasy to a legit plan. So, they start writing shit down. And they're like, one, we're going to need a van. Two, age limits are going to be from 13 to 19. When they got released from prison, they vowed to become reacquainted.
Because they were released at different times?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, you don't write shit that's sadistic.
Yet. So here is Bittaker's crimes, earlier crimes, and his early life. Okay. So, Lawrence, I'm sorry, but you're not fucking cool when your name's Lawrence. Mm-hmm. Sorry if your name's Lawrence, you're cool. He's not.
Larry.
Yeah. I don't know.
Hooray. There's lots of nicknames you can make from that.
Lawrence Bittaker was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on September 27th, 1940. He's an unwanted child of a couple that did not want kids. He was placed up for adoption, and he was adopted by Mr. and Mrs. George Bittaker. As an infant, he was adopted as an infant. Uh-huh. His dad worked in the aviation industry, which yeah. meant they moved around frequently from state to state as a kid. His first arrest comes at age 12 for shoplifting. After the next 4 years, his record grew more and more for shoplifting, petty thefts. He said he committed crimes to compensate for the lack of love from his parents.
I'm sure he got hugs.
You would think.
They saw fit to go out and adopt another person. You don't just... Well, I guess some people do that for monetary.
Some people do, yeah.
But where you adopt, you don't get state help, usually.
Yeah, you do. You get, like, a monthly check, don't you?
I thought that was foster care.
Oh, fuck, I don't know. Anyway, sorry. You guys, we side banter so much.
There we go,
much.
Yeah.
Yep, the love of it. Okay, so it's crazy, because he has done stupid-ass crimes, but this dude is nowhere near being a dum-dum of any sort. His IQ was 138.
Yeah.
Okay, so a normal IQ, you score between 90 and 110. This is according to Google. Superior intelligence is 110 to 120.
Uh-oh.
Very superior intelligence is 120 to 140.
Yeah.
Genius or near genius is 140 and over. So he scored 138. So we're near fucking genius. We're 2 points away from being a damn genius.
Yeah.
So obviously he's not that good. He looked at school and considered school to be boring and not excitive. Not excitive? That's what
yeah,
it says.
Yeah, they get kind of bored.
Mm-hmm.
Not challenged enough. That was early in the education system too. You know what I mean? They don't have... Maybe he wasn't challenged at school a lot.
Maybe he wasn't. I don't know.
So that's sociopath, though, because they're highly intelligent, and his dreams and interests are hurting and killing people.
Well, not yet. He's just a damn teenager right now. Right now, he's just a hooligan. We're just robbing people, robbing the gas stations.
Enjoying power, maybe?
Maybe. So he drops out in 1957. He and his parents were living in California for a year. The year of him dropping out.
Well,
a year after dropping out, okay, he gets arrested for car theft, hit and run, evading arrest. That lands him to being imprisoned uh-huh. at the California Youth Authority, where he remained until he was 18 years old.
No good. Don't run from the cops after you steal a vehicle. I think that's what that means.
Yeah, and I think he went across state lines. Another fuck up.
Well.
When he got out, he found out, this is a really shitty thing to find out when you get out of jail, that he was disowned, and they relocated to another state. He would never see his adopted family ever again.
They were embarrassed?
Yeah. Within days of his parole, he was arrested again. He's transporting a stolen car across state lines this time. Yeah. That's where I knew it came from. So, in August 1959, he was sentenced to 18 months in Oklahoma State Reformatory. Uh-huh. So, I'm guessing he went downward when he stole the car and went over state lines. He was later moved to a medical center for federal prisoners in Springfield, Missouri.
What, for psychiatric patients?
Mm-hmm. bless you.
Sorry.
To serve out the remainder of his time. In 1960, he was released from prison. Within months being released from prison, he was arrested for robbery.
Oh, dude can't get it.
No, he can't. And in May 1961, he was sentenced to 15 years and was diagnosed as being highly manipulative and being described as having considerable concealed hostility for Mexicans and hatred for people. I don't know. He says he was beat up by a Mexican family.
AKA narcissistic.
Sorry. Yeah.
So one family is an asshole to you doesn't mean that an entire... That's just...
Juvenile. I know. That's just dumb. So, he was released on parole in 1963 after only serving 2 years. Of a 15-year sentence.
2 years out of 15?
Uh-huh.
Did you say state?
We don't...
State doesn't.
We don't blame the states, I guess. In 1964, he went back for a parole violation. In 1966, he went under two more examinations by two more counselors. Both said they classified him as a borderline psychopathic, highly manipulative individual, unable to acknowledge the consequences of his actions.
Okay, so I've lost count. Is that 5 or 6 times in prison now?
5 or 6, yeah.
Jesus.
So he was...
Well, do you get tired of it, though? Because it interrupts your life, everybody else's life, except that I guess I don't understand the repetitiveness of it.
I don't know either. So he was prescribed antipsychotic medication... A year after his release into society, again, a month after parole in July 1967, he was again arrested and convicted of theft and leaving the scene of an accident. He was sentenced to 5 years, but released in April. In March 1971, again arrested for burglary due to repeated violations, he was given 6 months to 15 years. In October 1971, 3 years later, okay, so he got out. Now, 3 years later, he was arrested again. In 1974, he was arrested again. This time, he was arrested for assault with attempt to commit murder. He stabbed a young supermarket employee who accused him of stealing a steak. The worker saw him steal the steak.
Yeah.
And followed him.
You don't just pull that out of your ass.
Right. And followed him outside, asking him if he forgot to pay. When he responded by stabbing him in the chest,
whoa,
missing his heart by
whoa,
inches. By inches.
Whoa. The steak's $5, buddy. Jesus.
Two other supermarket employees saw this. When he tried to run away, those two supermarket employees restrained his ass. The employee's name is Gary Louie. He survived his stabbing. So, he was convicted of a lesser charge of assault with a deadly weapon and sent to the men's California. The men's colony in St. Louis Obispo,
so he didn't
California.
He didn't get attempted murder.
No. He just got aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. Yeah.
Do you have a picture of this fool?
Yeah, I'll show you.
All right.
After we're done and all that fun stuff. Yeah, I do. So gross. Both of them. Ew. And yes, I called them ugly. I am shaming them. They're disgusting.
Sometimes if you're ugly on the inside, it shows on the outside.
All right, so now we're going to learn about good ol' Roy. Okay, Roy Lewis Norris was born in Greenlee, Colorado, February 5th of 1948. He was conceived out of wedlock, so his parents married just so that they avoided the social stigma at the time.
Oh, for hell's sake.
Mm-hmm. His extended family lived within a short distance of his home because
yeah,
his grandfather was invested in some real estate at the time.
Oh.
His daddy worked on the scrap yard, and his mama was a drug-addicted housewife.
Ah.
Woo-hoo! He occasionally lived with him throughout his childhood and teen years, but was repeatedly placed in foster care for not being taken care of by parents, but they would always get him back. That's close to Idaho, so just think of Idaho's shitty parents and how they always get their babies back. Same thing is going on here. So he's just going back to these shitty people, and then going to good people, and then shitty people,
yeah,
and then good people.
It's good for kids to go through.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So, he was, yeah, like I said, he occasionally lived with them. And then he was in foster care throughout the whole state of Colorado. He had a very, very, very horrible, shitty childhood. He was neglected, severely neglected, they claim, by many of the foster families, frequently being denied food, clothing. He also claims that he was sexually abused in the care of a Hispanic family. Mm-hmm. He later says that's where his prejudice and his hatred comes for towards Hispanics. Because of how bad that one family was. So they have that relation. We're not really big fans of Hispanics, but it's weird because none of his people, victims, were like Hispanic.
Yeah.
None of them. It's fucking weird. Anyway, that's where their hates come from, and that's one of their bonding moments. So while living with his parents at 16 years old, help me out. He went to a female cousin's home.
Yeah.
She was in her early 20s and was saying really sexual things and, like, very pervy.
Yeah.
Good things. Step so off. She said, you better get the fuck up out of here. Right.
Yeah, that's weird.
She called his daddy.
Yeah.
His daddy reassures her, I'm gonna fuck him up, don't you worry.
Yeah.
I'm gonna whoop his ass. So, he goes, takes his dad's car, and attempts to commit suicide in the Rocky Mountains.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Huh. He was reported as a runaway, and then when he was found and then taken home. When he got home, his family informed him he and his little sister are unwanted children, and they are planning to divorce when the kids reach 13 years. A couple years later, that's what he goes home to.
Will like, the sister have anything to do with it?
Well, they're just saying. They're just, like, letting him know. Like, okay, you went and fucked up, okay? And now we're just going to let you know, while you're here, little Roy, you and your sister, we don't want you. Didn't want you. I can't stand this fool. So we're going to be divorcing pretty soon. Get used to it. Welcome home.
Oh, my God. Pancakes and a hug.
That's his life, not
much.
Mine. Yeah.
Much better to.
So later, he dropped out of school. I'm not shocked.
Yeah.
And he joins the Navy. He was stationed in San Diego in 1965. God, that picture to be so fun. Anyway.
San Diego's a fun town.
In 1965, too. Peace and love, bro. Okay. And was deployed to Vietnam. Oh. Sorry, I know it's Vietnam. I just say Vietnam for fun.
That's
in 1969, he did not see active combat during his 4 months of tour.
Good.
So that's good. When he got home, he was immediately honorably discharged from the Navy after one tour. He claims, his crimes. Claims. It's my fucking handwriting. I was like, wow, why does he claim that? He did it. Sorry. His crimes start in November of 1969. He was arrested for his first known sexual offense, where he was charged with the rape and assault and attempted admitted rape, where he attempted to force his way into a lone woman's vehicle. So that's really all it says. It doesn't say much about his, like, the...
What happened?
Well, because it was an attempted rape, but I don't know how it was attempted when he... I don't know if he was, like, saying things and that switched it. I don't know. Because I know if your wiener's out or something cray-cray like that, it's more serious than you just tried to get in my car. Because, like, your weenie's out and you planned on doing something with your wiener. I think. I'm almost 100% certain of that.
Lewd conduct.
Yeah.
Oh.
Fucking got attacked. So, sorry. 3 months later, in February of 1970, he attempted to talk a lady into letting him into her home. And she said, fuck no.
Well, good girl.
I don't know if she, like I said, guys, these ladies back then probably didn't cuss. I say she cussed. She said it.
Well,
she said, fuck no.
They're in Cali, so they should know. Because it's all also, wasn't that the time frame of all of those fun killers that you mentioned? Yeah.
So, he attempted to break in anyway, so she called the police, who arrested him. And in May 1970, while he was out on bail, he attacked a female student who he was stalking from the San Diego State University campus. So, this is super crazy. So, okay, he walks up, doesn't say a fucking word. Doesn't say a word. Okay, remember that. He's not talking. He smacks her in the back of the head until she falls, because her knees are buckling. She's not falling. When she falls to her knees, he puts, like, she falls down, okay? She's on her stomach down. He puts his knee on her lower back,
yeah,
on that bone right there, and starts bashing her fucking head in on the sidewalk.
Why?
And starts bashing her head onto the sidewalk. Shortly thereafter, he was charged with assault with a deadly weapon, and he was committed to a total of 5 years in the state hospital. He was classified with a mentally disordered sexual offender. He was released.
Well, yeah.
Isn't that cute? They give him such cute, adorable diagnosis, and they're like, now get your bags and go, sir.
Go to your counseling. You're fixed. Group on Tuesday.
You know what you are. You're a B and a D and a 4 together. So, go. Mm-hmm. In 1975, with 5 years probation, he had been declared by doctors as an individual who is no longer a danger to others.
Huh.
3 months later,
yeah,
after he got out, he approached a 27-year-old woman walking home from a restaurant in Redondo Beach, California. He offered her a ride on his bike. She said, fuck no. I'm assuming. So he pulled up the street, he parked that bike, grabbed her by her scarf, twisting it around her neck, choking her, informing her he intended to rape her, drags her in the bushes. Fearing for her life, she doesn't resist the rape, she just goes with it,
yeah,
and reports it to the cops. They don't know who it is. Until 2 months later, the victim's walking down the road and goes, huh, that's that motherfucker's bike right there.
Uh-huh.
Jots down the license plate number, calls police. Police find out who he is. He is arrested. And later tried and convicted and sent to California Men's Colony.
Oh, that's where he met his buddy.
Mm-hmm. So, Lawrence was released on October 5th, 1978.
Okay.
He goes to Los Angeles. Yeah. He finds work as a skilled mechanic. He's earning close to $1,000 a week.
Good job.
Yeah. He claims that he's a loner and that he didn't do anything, but he had several people in the neighborhood who was like, no, he has the reputation of being a very generous and helpful guy. He is a very nice man. He helps everybody in the hood. And he is occasionally known for his donations to the Salvation Army.
Okay.
And he would go buy large amounts of fast food and give it out to the homeless in downtown LA. Yep. And he was friends with all the teenagers in the neighborhood. And he was known for the teenagers as being the creepy fucker who had all the beer and the weed that you would just go hang out at his Burbank Hotel. Motel. Hotel's nice. Motel is not.
No. It didn't even have an apartment. He was making $1,000 a week. Are you serious?
And his hotel spot was known as the Kick-It Spot.
The Kick-It Spot.
Where they would go and be dumbass teenagers and smoke pot and drink. Which, hey, I had a creepy old dude here in Idaho Falls that's where I hung out. And I smoked his weed and drank his fucking shit. Didn't do nothing crazy that I'm aware of, but I do know a guy. Norris. Yeah, and I'm fine, they say. So, now we go to Roy. Yeah, I'm just going to call him Roy.
Sure.
His last name kind of reminds me of Morris, and I have a friend with that last name, and I feel like I'm tarnishing my friend's name, and I feel really bad.
It's a common last name.
We'll go with Roy. Yeah. He was released 3 months later on January 15th, 1979. He moved into his mama's house in Redondo Beach. He found work as an electrician in Compton. So, Bittaker, I know that's what I'm going to call him. I'm going to call him Bittaker. Wrote Norris a letter. Cute. In late February, saying, hey, let's meet up at this hotel.
So it's like a text.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He texts them, took a couple weeks to get there. It's fine. They rekindle their BFFness.
Yeah.
And then their plans to kidnap and rape girls is a go.
Oh, good. He was waiting for
it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, this plan has not left either one of these two's mind at all. Creepy as fuck.
Yeah.
So they get a van. And they're like, well, we need one with the big sliding glass. So the big, not the sliding glass door, but like, we need the big door. We need the big creepy door.
Sliding door.
Yep. So we can grab and pull teenagers in. So then they were like, what are you going to name it? And he's like, the van? And he's like, yeah. And then they both were like, murder van. Yeah.
I thought you were going to say rape mobile.
Nope.
Huh.
Just kidding. Murder Mac. Ah! Yeah!
Murder Mac.
They called it the Murder Mac.
Okay, well, at a certain age, you don't have to name your cars anymore. Just
they were
inspirational.
It was inspirational, okay?
Right.
I named my truck. Don't fucking talk shit. So, from February to June of 1970, they picked up over about 20 female hitchhikers. They did not harm them in any way, shape, or form. Any way, shape, or form. We're developing
skills.
A plan.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're practicing. We're doing dry runs. Ugh. So they're figuring out what ruses work. What words do they say to make women feel comfortable, to make women get in the van?
By the way, hitchhiking is not a good idea.
Back then it was, and it's fucked up.
Not in Cali.
Well, you should have been able to. God damn it. You should have been able to, but you weren't.
All of your top five were in Cali at one time, so.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay, so then, in late April, they're driving in the mountains.
Yeah.
And they're like, okay, we have our plan of how to get them in. Now, where do we go? Okay, let's drive up in the mountains. Let's find back roads. So they find a secluded fire road in St. Gabriel Mountains. They broke the lock on the gate and put their own lock on the gate.
Oh, handy.
So now we have taken possession. And I believe back then, 9/10 of the law, bro, who has the combo.
Well, in court is court. It takes a year to get there.
Yeah, so I'm pretty sure that's what happened. So, 2 months later, on June 24th, 1979, they finished putting the bed in the van. Okay, they bolt down this bed in the van. Under it, they put a cooler with some beer and some soft drinks, gentlemen, and a toolbox. Like, did I say clothes? Yeah, I said clothes. At 11 a.m., they drive to the beach. They're drinking, smoking pot, flirting with bitches, taking pictures, Polaroids. They didn't have a set routine yet, so they were like, okay, maybe we should go. Like, we've been here pretty fucking long. So at 7:46, they spotted 16-year-old Lucinda Lynn Schaefer, who was last seen leaving a Presbyterian church meeting in Redondo Beach, California. They spotted her walking down the road. Norris is the one who spotted her, saying, there's a cute blonde. Yep. And then they stop and offer her a ride. And
does she say no?
She says no. Oh. It doesn't work. She's a very responsible, very religious girl. She's 16 years old. She's very sweet and loving. She's very sweet. So they drive up ahead. And he gets out, acts like he's looking, Norris is out of the van, acting like he's looking for something in the van. Okay? So his shoulders and his head are in the van when she walks by. Then she walks by a little bit. He snatches her. She leaves a shoe behind. Into the van we go. Bittaker is driving the vehicle. So he turns up the radio to full blast. As Norris is in the back, Roy, bonding her arms and legs with duct tape. He gags her with the duct tape as well. Then they drive her all the way out to the locked road in the mountains. So she's freaking out at first. This is Norris's handwritten detail of it. He recalls that night. No, sorry, this is Bittaker. He wrote that she displayed a magnificent state of self-control and composure. Acceptance of the consequences of which she had found herself. And she had no control. She shed no tears. She offered no resistance. And exposed no great comfort, and expressed no great comfort for her safety. He shrugs his shoulders, saying, I guess she kind of knew what was coming. So at the fire road, Norris rapes her first. He tells Bittaker to go for a walk and come back in an hour. Mm-hmm. When he comes back, they switch. Norris now goes for a walk. He comes back. Now, the second time Norris is raping her, she asks him, are you going to kill me? He replies to her, no, we're not. She says, if you do, all I ask for is time to pray. Okay. So then they come back after raping her again. They argue over killing her or letting her free. She's begging while they're fighting for only a second to pray. Norris is attempting to strangle her. Her face... he's trying to strangle her, but after looking at her face for 45 seconds, he comes disturbed at the look in her eyes. He runs to the front of the van. He's throwing up. Bittaker then comes over. He's strangling her until she collapses to the ground. She starts convulsing. Then he takes a wire hanger around her neck and tightens it with vice grip pliers until she passes away. It was the size of a silver quarter when they got it off of her neck. And she was denied her request to pray. They wrapped her body in a shower curtain and throw her over a steep canyon Bittaker picked, and he even reassured Norris the animals would eat her up so there wouldn't be any evidence left. 2 weeks later, Andrea Joy Hall, on July 8th, 1978, was found hitchhiking along the Pacific Coast Highway. When they slowed down, another car also pulled up at the same time. She picked the first car, so they follow her for a very long distance until she gets out at the beach. This time, Norris walks up and talks to her. Norris is hiding in the back. Roy's hiding in the back. She thinks Bittaker is alone, yeah. So he offers her a drink. She says, yes, I want one. He says, okay, cool. They're in the cooler in the back. Oh, help yourself to them.
Yeah.
When she goes back there, Norris pounces on her. And she went fucking ballistic.
Yeah.
So she fought really, really hard. And he was twisting her arm and making her scream in pain. So he gags her with tape. He does the arms and the legs. They drove out to the fire road. She was raped 2 times by Bittaker and 1 by Norris. The second time Bittaker was raping her, Norris thought he saw headlights, so he dragged her into the bushes while Norris left in the van going down the road searching for the headlights to see what they were. When he got back... they get into the van, they drive deeper into the mountains. There, Bittaker is like, hey... dude, the first one, I was gone too fucking late. I'm going back to town. Fucking message me call me at the spot, I'll come get you, whatever. He goes away. So Bittaker makes Andrea walk naked uphill next to a road, making her give him oral sex, and then having her pose for several Polaroid pictures. Then they go back into the van. He comes back, they get her again, then they drive to a third spot where he makes her walk up another hill. This time Norris is like, I'm going to the store for a beer. Roy is. He's like, I'm going for a beer. When he gets back, Bittaker is alone. He has two Polaroid pictures with him that he shows of Andrea, and she is in sheer terror in both of them. As she begged for her life to be spared, Bittaker, well, that's what he told Norris. He said Andrea was going to, he told Andrea he was going to kill her and challenged her to give him as many reasons as she could come up with and as to why she should live before thrusting an ice pick through her ear into her brain. Then he turned her over, thrusting it into the other side and stomping on it until the handle broke. Then strangling her and throwing her off a cliff. We're on to victims 2 and 4. Jackie Doris Gillum, Jacqueline Leah Lamp, and she goes by Leah, so that's Jackie and Leah is who they're referred to. On September 3rd, they saw two girls sitting on a bus bench close to Hermesa Beach. They had then been, before, they were hitchhiking along the Pacific Coast Highway. They saw them resting at the bus stop. They offer the girls a ride. The girls accept. While in the van, they were accepted. They were asked drinks and marijuana, which they accepted. So while they were in the van, after a short little while, the girls notice that Bittaker was driving away from the beach and not towards the beach, like he said he was going to. They started freaking the fuck out. The guys were trying to lie to them. The girls were not playing up with their bullshit. Mm-hmm. They were not about to have it. So Leah, 13 years old, opened the door, and then Norris hit her in the back of the head with a bag of lead weights. She's knocked out briefly, and he says when he hit her, he's like, I fucking hit her hard. He's like, I didn't expect her to wake up for hours. Hours. But anyway.
Oh, honey.
It only briefly knocks her out. Then they overpower 15-year-old Jackie. He bounds and gags her. Bounds Jackie. Leah starts coming to and again tries to flee the van. Norris twists her arm behind her back, drags her back into the van. As she struggles in the van, in full view of potential witnesses, he punches her in the fucking face. And he tells the people, don't worry, she's having an LSD trip. Bitch is crazy. It's all good. Like, we're just having a personal moment. Go about your tennis. So, those people do.
Wow.
Yeah. So now he helps Norris in the binding and the gagging of them. Because he's like, dude, get the fucking...
Let's hurry up.
Jesus, you can't handle it yourself? They're children. Ugh. So then they drive to the mountains, where they were held for almost 2 days. Being bound and gagged between acts of sexual and physical abuse, both men also slept in the van alongside of them. They would take turns acting as lookouts on occasion. Bittaker would walk Leah to a hill and force her to pose graphically. Okay, so the thing about Leah is she is not raped because she is of a bigger body build. Mm-hmm. They didn't find her attractive in that way. They did, like, beat her up and obviously murder her, but she wasn't raped. So I guess she sees all this horrific shit, but at the end, I think death is the best. But anyway, makes her pose for pornographic pictures before returning her to the van. He also had Norris take pictures of him while they raped Jackie. They took pictures of each other and took pictures of them sleeping next to her naked. And they took pictures with her with clothes and without clothes. So the first three times Bittaker raped Jackie, he recorded it and forced her to pretend that she was his cousin, telling her to feel free to express her pain. And she's like, well, you told me to act like I like it. And he's like, oh yeah, we're done with that. Feel free to scream out in terror. He says that he buried this tape in a cemetery. The tape has never been found. He also stabbed her in the breast with the ice pick and used vice grip pliers to tear off her nipple.
Oh.
After 2 days, Norris said at Bittaker's trial that he suggested that Jackie be killed quickly. Unlikely as she had been cooperative and been through the worst, because she had been raped that whole 2 days and tortured and beat up. Bittaker says, no, they only get to die once. Leah was stabbed in the ears and strangled to death. After Leah was killed, he forced Jackie, out, yelling at her and said, you wanted to stay a virgin? Smacks her in the back of the... Oh, no. Sorry. Wow. I am so fucked up, you guys. I am so sorry.
Great.
Jackie was the one that he stabbed in the ears and strangled her to death. After that, Leah was forced out of the van. And he's yelling at Leah that you wanted to stay a virgin. Now you can die one. Norris struck her in the back of the head with a sledgehammer. Bittaker then started strangling her. He thought that she was dead until she opened her eyes and freaked them both the fuck out. So Norris began to bludgeon her again with the hammer while being strangled by Bittaker. The bodies were thrown over an embankment into a grassy land area. Okay.
What is wrong with
you guys? You guys. So. I'm going to pre-warn you guys
right now.
This last victim is where I had to stop. I might even probably kind of cry. I will keep it together. And yeah, this is the last victim. And then we get to go on the good shit of them getting caught and everything else. Okay.
Do you have earmuffs I can wear for a minute?
No. Shirley Lynette Ledford is their final victim. On October 31st, 1979, 16-year-old Shirley was abducted as she stood outside a gas station, hitchhiking home from a Halloween party in Sunland, Tuscany, a suburb of L.A., Cops believe she accepted because Bittaker went to the restaurant that she worked at part-time as a waitress after getting to know him. So she must have felt comfortable with him in some way, shape, or form.
Like regular.
Yeah, she kind of knew him. He offered her some weed. She said no. Bittaker drove to a secluded street where Norris pulled a knife and bound and gagged her with construction tape. Bittaker then trades places with Norris, who now is driving aimlessly for hours. Bittaker told him to go to the highway, like try to get on the highway and just go. So he turns up the music, right? So he's like, okay, this is a normal routine. We're going to return this up. Bittaker goes up, turns it down. And he is like, no, keep it down. He turns on the recorder automatically. He's never done this before. Mm-hmm. He starts the tape. He starts tormenting her and slapping her and mocking her and beating her. He's punching her with his fist repeatedly, shouting for her to say something. And he's saying, say something, girl. Say something, girl. And she's begging and pleading, what do you want me to say? Mm-hmm. She's screaming. She's shouting. When she starts doing that, he says, scream louder. As she keeps screaming, he starts hitting her. And he says, what's the matter? Don't you like to scream? She's begging and she's pleading, saying, don't touch me, don't hit me, don't stop. He then ordered her to scream as loud as she wished. And then he began to beat her. And changing in between striking her with a hammer and beating on her breast with his fist. He tortures her with pliers both in between and throughout the acts of rape and sodomization. Shirley had been heard on the tape begging for it to stop. She's heard multiple times saying things as, oh no, oh no. As he uses the sledgehammer or the pliers and or grabs pliers from the toolbox. You can hear on the tape when, sorry, when the tape is, now the tape is off, when it's turned back on, Norris hears constant screams. So, he used the pliers so viciously in his rapes that Norris was unable to rape her. It was all one. She was ripped open. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Guys, it's so hard. So shortly after, they switch places. And now Norris is also in the back. He also turns on the tape recorder. He starts shouting at her, go ahead and scream or I'll make you scream. He's asking her, why isn't she screaming like she did for Bittaker? And she says, okay, okay, I'll scream if you stop hitting me. Then you can hear several high-pitched screams. And then Norris saying, continue until I tell you to stop. Norris grabs the sledgehammer. And this is where she starts screaming, no, no, no. This is where I turned it off. He then hit her in her left elbow.
Oh, fuck her.
She starts screaming, it's broken, it's broken. He says, no, it's not. She starts begging and pleading, don't hit me again, don't hit me again. He hits her about 25 times in the same elbow. As she screams, no, 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 he says, what are you shivering about? As she continued to scream and wept. For 2 hours of captivity and torture, Norris finally killed her by strangling her with a wire coat hanger that he had tightened with pliers.
Ew, dude.
She didn't fight at the end. She died with her eyes open. Bittaker thought he could see the reaction, wanted to see the reaction from the press, and so they drove into a random selected house in the Sunland area and discarded her body on a bed of ivy in the front lawn. She was found by a jogger the following morning. Her autopsy showed, in addition to having been severely violated, her death was strangulation after receiving extensive blunt force trauma to the face, the head, the breast, the left elbow. Her left elbow sustained multiple fractures. Her genitalia and rectum had been torn, caused by the pliers being inserted in and out of her body. Her left hand had puncture wounds all the way through, and her right finger was smashed. Bittaker would later claim, in his trial that the tape of her abuse and her torture offered nothing other than evidence of a threesome that got out of hand. And she is heard by the end of the audio tape screaming for them to kill her and to just get it over with and kill her. So the investigation is as followed. In November 1979, Nora saw an old friend named Joseph Jackson, who had been locked up before at the men's colony with them. Over time, Nora starts telling him about what they had done over the last 5 months in graphic detail, and especially of Shirley's death, the only body they had at the time. He also told Jackson about the other three girls that he raped and they tortured and released. After hearing this story, Jackson calls his attorney, who told him to call the police. He also agreed that he needed to call police. He has a 13 and a 14-year-old daughter at the time. He and his attorney went to the LA Police Department to give over the information. The LA Police Department told him, we can't handle it, right? Like, this isn't our shit. Go to the Redondo Police Department, where Detective Paul Dunham was assigned the case. He found out Norris's confession did match reports on file, like the ones Jackson described to him. There was one that stuck out as a chick was sprayed in the face with mace and raped by two white men on September 30th. Her name is Robin Bodek. She did report the crime, but didn't know who they were.
Yeah, because you're blinded.
So Detective Paul sent a photo array to Oregon, where she now lived. She picked out Bittaker and Norris as the men who kidnapped and raped her on September 30th. Upon linking them to Robin's case, the Hermosa Police Department placed Norris under surveillance. Within days, he is seen in his window bagging up and weighing out marijuana. So on November 20th, 1979, Norris was arrested at Hermosa Police Department for a parole violation. The same day at the hotel in the Burbank, Bittaker was arrested for the rape of Robin. She picked them out of a photo lineup, but she was unable to pick them out of a person lineup. But that didn't matter because they had him on the probation violations. So they both go to jail on parole violations. A search of Bittaker's house reveals several pictures of Andrea and Jackie, who are both have been reported missing earlier in the year. In the van, they find a sledgehammer, a plastic bag of lead weights, a police scanner, a jar of Vaseline, two necklaces that belong to two of the victims, a tape of a young woman obviously under distress and screaming and pleading for mercy while being tortured and raped. Shirley's mom identified her voice on the tape.
Honey.
The voice of being her only daughter. In Bittaker's apartment, they found various bottles of acid materials that they found out were for the next girl. In Norris's place, they found Shirley's bracelet. In both homes, totaled over 500 pictures of teenage and young girls they had been taken on Rodeo Beach and Hermosa Beach in between, and the Burbank High School. And the pictures were obviously taken without consent. Now we'll go to the confession. On November 30th, 1979, Norris went to a preliminary hearing of the rape on September 30th. Norris began to display attitude and sassiness at the hearing, and he waived his remainder rights before questioning related to Robin's rape. Norris flatly denied any involvement in any murders, rapes, or disappearances. When he was confronted with the evidence that he had, he started singing like a canary. He did most everything. He confessed to most everything and put most things on Bittaker. On Bittaker. And he told them that Bittaker was more of the murderer guy. And that he was, when he talked to them, they said that he was cold, casual, and unconcerned of the matter. Saying they would drive around looking, taking pictures, smoking pot. And that he got off over the power. And having them, and driving them up to the mountains and killing them. He does say in his confession, the bottles of acid that they found in Bittaker's motel were for the next girl for acts of torture and humiliation. He is quoted as saying acts of fun. The police found 19 pictures of women and individuals who had been reported missing. But there is no conclusive evidence to say that they had anything to do with them except for the 5 they have. Some of the pictures look very, very familiar, had very familiar backgrounds, the same as Hall, Lamb, and Gillum. Putting Bittaker and Norris said they never knew about any of them. But Norris is the one who rats on Bittaker and takes the deal.
Yeah.
So for the search of the mountains, Lucinda and Andrea have never been found.
Oh, honey.
On February 9th, 1980, the skeletonized body of Jackie and Leah were found at the bottom of the canyon along a dry riverbed. Their skeletal remains were scattered over 100 feet in diameter. The ice pick was still in Jackie's head, stuck in her skull. In February 1980, they were formally charged with the murders of the 5 girls. Bittaker was denied bail, and Norris's bail was set at $10,000.
What?
Within a month of being charged, Norris accepted the plea deal to testify against him as long as they took the death penalty off the table. On March 18th, 1980, Norris pled guilty to 4 counts of murder and 1 count of second-degree murder of Andrea Hall, 2 counts of rape, 1 count of robbery. His formal sentencing was postponed until May 7th. The deal was no death and no life without parole. In his pre-sentencing interview, the guy who did it said Norris felt the feeling of power over his victims, the dominance that the men had over them and the factor as opposing a sexual, and I don't know, a sexual sadist,
mm-hmm.
never exhibiting any remorse or compassion about his brutal act towards any of them. The victims and the defense the defense pointed out that he didn't show any type of remorse whatsoever,
mm-hmm.
towards any of them.
He just didn't give a fuck.
He didn't give 2 fucking shits.
I mean, my God.
Yeah.
That's above sedition. Why did they keep letting these guys out of jail in the first place?
I don't know. He is quoted as saying he never exhibited any remorse or compassion about his brutal acts towards the victims. The defendant appeared composed in his need to inflict pain and torture upon women. He said Norris is sadistic. and can be looked at as an extreme psychopath who has an unpraved pattern of behavior that is beyond rehabilitation. On May 7th, 1980, Norris's sentence was 45 years to life, where he was eligible for parole starting in 2010.
Oh, it comes with a surprise. See?
On April 24th, 1980, Bittaker was arraigned on 29 charges of kidnapping, rape, sodomy, murder, and criminal conspiracy, possession of a firearm. He was also charged with 2 counts of conspiracy to commit murder from the acts he did in December 1979 when he tried to peer pressure 2 inmates that were getting out to murder Robin to prevent her from testifying. That case against Robin's case against him, though, unfortunately, was eventually dropped due to the lack of the physical evidence and her inability to identify them in the physical lineup. When Judge William Hollingsworth asked for his plea, Bittaker says nothing. He refuses to answer any questions, so the judge says he's going to enter a not guilty on his behalf. The trial starts on January 19th, 1981. He was tried in Torrance, California? Is that a place? Torrance, California. Before Judge Thomas Fredrickson Norris began his testimony on January 22nd.
Ugh.
When responding to a question, he said, brought him to this. In June 1979, he himself, tried to attack and rape and abduct a woman who had gotten away unharmed. When he went and told Bittaker about it, they agreed from then on they would start doing it as a team. And they went over their, like, official, like, you hog tie him, I murder.
What were the plan?
So, that abduction, like, the attempted abduction of Jan Milan, it happened September 30th. She got away scot-free. Okay. Another young woman on the 27th. Norris said the only killing he himself did was the killing of Shirley. And that is because she had not killed anyone yet. Because Bittaker told him he had to kill one of them because he had not. And Bittaker did kill all of them.
Yeah.
Except for the last one. The most damning piece of evidence, though, was the 17-minute audio tape from the van.
They played that shit in court.
Bittaker, while it played people in court, jurors, people, were losing their shit. The one audio clip we will play for you is only reason the press got it is because somebody leaves the courtroom during that time having a mental fucking breakdown. So the door is flung open.
Yeah.
And so they get a snidbit of the tape.
He was probably reliving the moment.
He was smiling throughout the playing of the videotape. So before the tape is played, the On January 29th, the defense attorney, Stephen K., gives this following warning to the jury. For those of you who don't know what hell is like, you will find out. And press play on the tape. There was more than 100 people in the courtroom that lost their minds and were very highly affected from this tape till this day. This is the same defense attorney from the Manson cases, okay? Yeah. And he straight says that fucking Manson's a bitch compared to this. And that he still has nightmares hearing the girl scream and getting there in time to see her die. Anyway. Bittaker was undisturbed, like I said, and smiling out throughout the recording.
So he didn't give a shit.
Mm-mm. On February 5th, 1981, Bittaker testified on his own behalf. He denied any knowledge in any of the actions or murders of anyone of Schaefer, and he claimed he paid Hall to pose for the Polaroids, indicating that he found her Burbank Motel. He took her to the hotel and Hall agreed as he offered $2,200 for sex, and then claims that Norris walked Hall into the mountains and returned alone. And he told Bittaker that Hall said she would find her own way home from the mountains. Bittaker had a similar explanation for the double murder of Jackie and Liam. He claimed Jackie accepted the money for sex and posing for the pictures, and that he had last seen the girls alone with Norris in his GMC van.
Oh, so he just threw Ding Dong under the bus.
With regards to the murder of Shirley, he claimed that she had agreed to act scream on the videotape and that she was not tortured in her audio, and that he had left her alone with Norris, and that's what he testified. Mm. His trial lasted for over 3 weeks. He was described as an excuse for a man. The case is referred to as one of the most shocking, brutal cases of American history crime. If the death penalty is not appropriate in this case, then it will never be. Stating in his closing arguments. This is what Kay said in his closing arguments. Deputy District Attorney Ralph Ramsey declared Bittaker's claims that, contrary to Norris's testimony, Shirley Lynn had agreed to scream, weep, and plead for mercy. And the tape recording that they heard, the sounds on the tape of Mrs. Ledford screaming and yelling, "Don't touch me. No, 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 no." That tape itself should be thrown out. Defense attorney said that the testimony was nothing more than bloodlust, saying that the gory details of the tape never should have been added in any way. The courts never should have heard him.
Why in the world not?
Yeah, because according to them, she was pretending to do that. She was pretending. On February 17th, 1981, after deliberating for 3 days, the jury found Bittaker guilty on 5 counts of first-degree murder, 1 charge of conspiracy to commit murder, 5 charges of kidnapping, 9 charges of rape, 2 counts of forcible oral copulation, one charge of sodomy, three charges of unlawful possession of a firearm, distributions, deliberations of whether Bittaker should be have the death penalty or given life parole would begin on February 19th. The jury deliberated for just 90 minutes before returning with their verdict. Bittaker was sentenced to death for the five counts of first-degree murder upon possession. He showed no emotions as this verdict was given by Superior Court Judge Thomas Fredrickson. The order of Bittaker, he appealed the court's decision on, he was told to appear in court on March 14th for formal sentencing. On March 24th, in compliance with the jury's verdict, Bittaker was given his formal sentence of death. In the event of the sentence imposed, there had been reverted to life without life with imprisonment. Judge Thompson sentenced him to 199 years and 4 months, and that his imprisonment must be taken immediately. Bittaker appealed his conviction, saying there were errors on the warrant for his van, his motel room.
You do have the right to appeal.
Yeah. The judge, and the audio tape is one of his appeals that he said the audio tape, they were all dismissed. An execution date for Bittaker was set for December 29th, 1989. Bittaker appealed this decision, though on June 11th, 1990, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the decision that he be executed. A renewed execution date was scheduled for July 23rd, 1991. Bittaker again appealed the decision to the Supreme Court that he could not be executed, and was granted a further stay of execution on July 9th,
1991.
Why? I don't know.
He didn't let anybody else live.
Right. Several death row interviews following his 1991 conviction. He had never expressed any remorse for his crimes, stating any remorse or that he had felt anything upon his arrest. The fact that Norris was arrested, and this was ruining his life. Despite the fact Bittaker considered his own life to be a quote-unquote wasted one. He also marveled that he and Norris had little in common before they became acquaintances in the California men's colony in 1977. And adding that, quote, they have one hell of a lot in common now, end quote. In reference to one of the implements he and Norris had used to torture their victims, Bittaker's response to the letters that he received from fans and everything else, because he would write you back, he would sign his name using his nickname, quote-unquote, Pliers Bittaker. While incarcerated, he filed more than 40... various lawsuits over issues striving from having broken cookies or crushed sandwiches by the prison cafeteria people. He cited an example of being subjected to cruel and unusual punishment. Bittaker was declared an what is that?
He was declared vexatious litigation?
Yeah, it's a legal action in which is brought solely upon people who harass. Okay, so it's just stating that this is someone that he is a fucking douchebag.
Where does he get all the money to sue everybody?
He has public defenders.
Are you serious? To the Supreme Court. Public defender? Mm-hmm. Really?
Yep. Really. In a result of his declaration, he was not allowed to file any more lawsuits without permission from an attorney or a judge. Bittaker died while being incarcerated on death row at San Quentin State Penitentiary. Yes. Yay! Good. On December 13th, 2019, at the age of 79, his death was reported as being natural causes. Norris remains incarcerated in Donavana State Prison since his conviction. He has repeatedly claimed the sole reason for his participation in the murders was fear of Bittaker. Norris also claims he has twice confessed to his and Bittaker's responsibility in the murders to police. He has also given He described. Mm-hmm. He visually described three chicks that tried to get in the van but were let go. So they were like, good boy. Ah. Yeah. Norris admits that he enjoyed the acts endorsed with the victims. He claims that Bittaker enjoyed the acts of torture and murder, stating, quote, "I don't enjoy killing. That was Lawrence. It was his favorite part. Watching the women struggle to live, knowing he'd soon be taking their life away." Huh. Yeah. Both people have stated that Norris gets extreme gratification from dominance, abuse, torture inflicting upon his victims. Excluding no parties. And he has extensive history in physical and sexual violence against women prior to meeting.
Yeah.
Because he bashed that poor lady's, that girl's head in at the school. Uh-huh. Norris did become eligible for parole in 2019. What? He declined to go to his parole hearing, thereby automatically deferring his parole eligibility for another 10 years. He was denied again parole in 2019. He will not be eligible again until 2029. The prosecutor says that this trial was one of the worst trials he has ever seen. Paul, the chief of investigators of the murders committed by Bittaker and Norris, he committed suicide in December of 1986. The lead detective did. Wow. He was 39 years old.
Oh, honey.
In a 10-page suicide note, he refers to the murders committed by Bittaker and Norris as haunting him, and his fear that they may be one day released from prison. That was part of his suicide.
Oh, Jesus.
The audio cassette tape of Bittaker and Norris raping and torturing her remains in the possession of the FBI Academy. This recording is now used in the training of desensitizing FBI agents and showing them the reality of raw torture and murder. There's a film made by him for of them. It's a 2012 documentary, The Devil and the Death and the Death Penalty, an autobiography, two autobiographies that were written. One of them, the chick goes and like
interviews him,
talks to him and shit, and it's just crazy. I don't know. There's three shows. There's a 1982 documentary called The Killing of America. There's a crime documentary series called Arrested in Trials, and a broadcast episode detailing the murders committed. It was broadcasted in October 2000, and then the investigation discovery. So, that, you guys, is the story of the toolbox killers, and then I'll play you guys the...
Did their mothers go to court, you think?
I don't know, Jesus. Dude. Like, I couldn't even fucking imagine. Like, I truly just... Mm-mm. I couldn't even... What do you even do? You know what I mean? Like, when those are your people and they commit crimes like that, what do you even do? Like, truly.
You skip trial and go to sentencing. No, I'm just... They're still your people. You know? I mean, that's an individual decision because, like, the adoptive family turned around and was like, hey, we don't know you anymore, deuces.
Right.
So, that kind of pain, that's going to help your trust issues. I don't know, though. Everybody knows right and wrong, and, I mean...
I just...
To be able to torture someone to that capacity...
Do it any time. Ever use an ice pack? No, sir.
Who's this?
Bittaker.
Lamp with a sledgehammer. You recall the sledgehammer which was introduced to every door. Was that true?
No, sir. Lawrence Bittaker, with an IQ of 138, dragged high school girls into his van, then murdered them by twisting a coat hanger around their throat with a pair of pliers. When his tape recording of one murder was played in court, people rushed outside and vomited.
He touched Miss Ledford on the breast with the cold metal pliers. If you listen to the tape, you'll hear those pliers being replaced in the toolbox a few seconds later.
Oh, what did you touch her on the breast for with a pair of pliers?
To shock her with the cold metal.
Charlie Ledford would be 55 years old this year. Instead, her family continues to mourn her tragic loss nearly four decades after she was brutally attacked. Today, they are known as the Toolbox Killers, but prior to 1979, Lawrence Bittaker and Roy Norris were career criminals.
Dude, it's just absolutely horrible, and like, I don't... I don't know. Dude, like, I just... People like that... And it just shocks me how many times they get out of jail. And how many times...
How far it has to go.
Yeah. Like, how far we let them as a society push it.
Mm-hmm.
Is absolutely horrible.
Well, it's... We sentenced to 15 years and what he served to you the one time... You have to look at the crime and the pattern. Kept
right.
Kept going back.
Okay, you guys listen super, super closely because you have to listen, like, really hard. So that you can, like, hear it, but, yeah, you guys, that's it.
That would be, you're just walking down the road one day, or, you know,
yep.
And I won't say what site I found the, like, actual recording on. If you guys want to look into it, that's on you. But... there's things that I don't know why the fuck I click on them. But I do want to just say real quick, like, that they called the first victim, her name, she went by Cindy, even though we already went through it and everything else, it was Lucinda. She went by Cindy. Her body was never found. She was reported missing by her grandmother. Andrea, who was kept for one day, she was never found. Her sister and her brother-in-law were the ones that reported her missing. Jackie and Leah were kept for 2 days. They were found. With the ice pick still in Jackie's head. Shirley was found in the front yard. When they got her back to the morgue, the hanger size around her neck was the size of a silver dollar.
Well, it's massive. Back in the day.
That's the size her neck was. Oh. With that cord around it. And then Joe Jackson was the former inmate who gave up the information. So, you guys, that's our version of the toolbox, the toy box. We get the toolbox. They got the toy box. There you guys go.
Oh, my God. I need a paper bag in here because it just, I have a hard time. I could have lived my entire life.
Not knowing any of that.
Not having that picture in my effing head.
I almost cried. I almost cried, you guys. Stop. I don't cry.
Stop.
I almost cried. Oh. Yeah. So.
This is a PG-13 episode.
Fuck PG-13. This shit be R, bro. Oh, I got sick.
I can't even believe it.
No, it's horrible.
I can't even believe it.
So one shares air with us till this day. One died. You know, we get some justice in some fucked up way, but. That's it, guys. So let us know what you guys think, of course. Follow us, like us. Please go give love to our iTunes and, like, rate us and stuff. Because, like, we have some 1 stars and, like, a bad review where this lady says that she judges us off of listening to 1 episode. You can clearly tell. And it's one of the first ones. Yeah. And I don't disagree with what she said, except for that part where she says you lose brain cells listening to my podcast. You don't.
That's excessive.
That's kind of rude. Yeah. But, like, you know, we're working on it, guys. We're still new into this. We're only 31 episodes in this bitch. Calm the fuck down. Show some love, you know? Build us up. Don't tear us down, you know? Oh. But, yeah, you guys, tell us what you guys think, because that was super hard. So.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I'm really glad that...
it's over.
The one guy's dead.
Yeah.
And I can't wait for the other one to be the same. I'm sorry.
It's truly horrible. So yeah, if you guys want to see their pictures and all that fun stuff, follow us, like us. Like us on Twitter at itiswhatitis208, because that's where we're from. On Facebook, it is what it is, a true crime podcast. On Instagram, itiswhatitispod19, all one word. On YouTube, it is what it is, a true crime podcast. And if you guys cannot find it, go ahead and either type Gene or Shaw Marie into either one of those search bars. You guys will find us. It's there. And also on YouTube is my playlist. That's public view, I guess. Me and my husband had a good little mini sesh jamming out to some oldies. It was fun.
Good.
I'm into rap, just so you guys know. So fuck, add it onto the playlist if you guys want. I don't give a shit. Anyway, but yeah, my playlist is public, so fun. So yeah, you guys, peace the fuck out.
Thanks, guys. Whoa.
Sorry.
Ugh.
Not sorry.